Thanks for listening to this Arrow FM podcast, shared on accessmedia.nz with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Welcome to the June edition of Book Lovers Wairarapa.
Very good,
glad
Gareth.
I got that right.
Yes.
And look, you've found the show on Wairarapa TV, Wairarapa Arrow FM. That looks at what is memorable and wonderful in books, and it is it's a terrifically apt time today with the weather that books are the focus, because if there's never the time when being close to a source of warmth and a good book, it doesn't get much better. I'm Gareth Rapson, and I'm with co-host Steve Lawrence.
Hello, Gareth.
Now, Steve is the owner of Elmo's Bookshop and, our famous city councillor in the Valley, of course. And he always starts us off with a little look at what's happening with Why Word.
Okay, well, we've had the June edition of Why Word, which should have been, we made a special effort to make it the first Sunday of the month, and then the lady from Levin, who was going to come and present, got COVID, and so she arrived on the 23rd, which in fact was just Sunday. That's a lady called Catherine J. Adams. And in between us inviting her and her turning up, her book, Tonight I Burn, is shortlisted for the New Zealand Children's Book Awards in the young adults section.
And that's about to be announced soon.
Yes. So she came along and did a two-hour workshop on not so much about writing, but more about how to get published internationally, because that's what she has managed to achieve. This Tonight I Burn, her first novel, has been published in, obviously, New Zealand by Hachette, but also published in the States, and has been translated into four languages, one of which is Hebrew. I don't know how that works.
Well, that would fit in with the current Israeli policy of destroying everything around them. So tonight, what is the title again?
Tonight I Burn.
Tonight I Burn. Yes, it's okay. I get the link.
Yeah. So she came along and talked to people about that, and then how did she do it?
What was her secret?
Well, I didn't go to the workshop, so I don't really know. But she wrote her book and sent it to an agent who happened to be in the States. And the agent pitched it to some publishers, and Hachette picked it up. And
I mean, it's a pretty fantastic story, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, to do that is very, very hard to do.
And in between times, she, I think, having sent it off to the agent who made a few suggestions and then got the shit editors involved, she's probably rewritten the thing about six times.
As you do. But that's all for the good.
Yeah. And in the end, she's finished up with this.
So what is this Tonight I Burn?
Well, she was interesting to talk to because this month, June, is Out on the Shelves month, which is about LGBTQ, etc., literature, and this is a kind of a same-sex relationship. But she says what she likes to write about is where the fact that the protagonists, maybe LGBTQ, is actually not the story, it's ancillary to the story, it's just that's how they happen to be.
Yep.
Which is kind of how I think most people kind of view things now. Nothing's remarkable anymore.
It's an interesting one. Just come back from my holiday in the States, and yeah. I had a terrific talk with a librarian in Miles City, Montana, about these sort of books, which are hugely controversial in America.
Yes.
Due to the
strange nature of some Americans.
Well, yeah, it's just there's a particular group of parents who are absolutely against libraries and schools having a bar of this.
Mm.
And in fact, they're in total denial that it actually exists as an idea.
Mm.
And there's a lot of pushback by some of the, you know, the libraries to actually have this material available. And yet the libraries are then, you know, up in front of, you know, councils saying, what are you doing?
Funding slashed.
And the library staff had, you know, bigots and books and, you know, all this sort of T-shirts. It was very, very topical. So it's interesting that this is another a book in the mix.
Yeah. But that's not the main thing that the book's about. The book's, it's a world-building fantasy.
Is there a volume two?
She's sold three books. So this is, it's a trilogy.
Terrific, yeah.
So she's done really well.
Yeah, and I think hopefully that just becomes part of the background. And in fact, that's how these gender issues and identity issues become accepted, is through literature.
Hmm.
It's just there and we grow with it, and it's just part of the culture. Well,
that's the only intelligent question I asked her was, why is she Catherine J. Adams? Is there another Catherine out there somewhere? And she said, no, well, I think this is quite a nice story. I debated whether I'd, you know, publish under my married name or my maiden name. We just said we'd publish under my married name. But when I was growing up, my dad, in England, my dad built a boat, which he called the Catherine J, and we used to go on all our holidays on it, and I just wanted a bit of a hat tip to him. And I thought that was really quite cute.
That is good. And that's you and I will be terrific in a quiz night, you know, when that question comes up.
Yep.
We'll be all over that, why
Catherine is one of the great stalwarts of New Zealand literature. We'll be the only ones who know why she's Catherine J. Adams.
Yep.
It's named after a boat.
And there's an audience, you know, in Elmo's. I mean, people come in, or is it just going to be found generally when people in the young adult section?
Well, I don't know where to put it. We put it down the front by itself, and where we put the Y Word featured books. Because I don't necessarily think this is a young adult novel. It's not priced like one. It's $27.99, which is getting up towards, it's kind of midway between adult fiction and young adult fiction in terms of pricing. It's a big book.
We like big books.
Yeah.
Well, it's winter. I like slim books in the summer, big books in the winter.
Yeah.
The school library is going to pick this up in New Zealand. I mean, any book that gets on the short lists, you know, will be on their buying lists.
Mm.
And good on them. And and if it's going to be a trilogy, I mean, I think there's an appetite for books like this. It's in the news. It's what everybody's talking about.
Yeah, and it is this whole book talk thing that, you know, the TikTok generation.
Yeah.
And they're focusing on books to a large extent. It sort of bypasses us a little bit. We just don't have a whole bunch of teenagers in Carterton, really. We haven't got a high school.
Yeah. And that's a good point. So I can see this being a big urban book where,
yeah,
you know, there's and also it's a big cities have the whole range of, you know, all the gender politics, and though I guess we've got to stop saying that and go, actually, this is a book.
It's a book.
It's an adventure. Mm. Is it a thriller? Yeah.
It's a fantasy about, yeah.
Sci-fi?
No, it's witchy. And sort of supernatural, little bits of set around libraries. Got these things in them called book sprites, which are a little bit malevolent.
Oh, those librarians, they always get it. Okay. Hey, well, let's look. This sounds like a terrific Y Word guest. And moving on, who's the July?
Well, July, we have James Hollings coming. James is Associate Professor of Journalism at Massey. So he's going to come along and talk about journalism and research, but his big claim to fame, and the reason I think we'll get quite a big audience for it, is he's a co-author of a very recent book about the Crewe murders. And that's kind of set in the psyche of most New Zealanders of a certain age. We all still want to know who fed the baby, don't we?
Well, we do. I mean, over when it gets all dark over the dinner, you know, with a group of people, that's one of the – that often starts there, and it's when then we move up through the, you know, the sounds, murders, and the – you know, the David Tamahiri, and you know, it just goes on and on. All the great. It's a long time ago now, but it's and so the younger audience. This is a boomer book. Mm. But I mean, he's obviously going to talk about more things than that too. So,
well yeah, I mean, so two events again. He's going to come along and do his journalism workshop, so people can register for that. And then at 4 o'clock on the 7th of July in the Carterton Community Courthouse, he'll come along and talk about the Crewe murders. So.
The courthouse, how apt.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's just a lovely venue. I really like it in there.
Yeah. No, I do too. It's
and we can set it up for 10 people or 100. It's always warm. It's genuinely historic, so there's something. You sort of, there's a bit of a feeling about it, and it... yeah, it's a great addition to the Carterton panoply of
these are two terrific Y-Word speakers. I mean, you have a great program. Mm. Who actually contacts them and signs them up?
Well, we a very small group of people, four or five people. We sit down towards the end of the year and work out who we think we might like to come along next year. We've been doing this for... since 2012, so 10 years now, 12 now, years now. So
generally the authors are happy to sign up.
We've got a little bit of cred now, so people know a little bit about us. And you know, some people have never been here.
Hey, come and discover the beautiful Wairarapa.
Exactly.
It all works. Actually, I hope you're getting council support for this.
We get some money from Carterton Creative Communities to help us out.
Perfect. Well, look.
That's Wairarapa Word.
It is, and it's very, very interesting. Now, when I came in and caught you, you know, drinking your coffee, you actually had a Lee Charles book. What was that about? I haven't seen this. I pride myself on seeing all the new books, but this one...
Well, this is not even a new book. This won't be out until Father's Day. So this is a pre-release copy in hardback, actually. So this is a Lee Child, but it's not a Jack Reacher. So this is a collection of short stories by Mr. Child. And I've only had it a couple of days, so I've read a few. And I just... short stories are interesting things. And he, Lee Child, likes short stories and admires the people who can write them. And he compares a good short story to a Fabergé egg, something small, perfectly formed. And I'll just read you this a little bit about him writing short stories. The illusion that no one was watching was the best thing ever. It made the stakes non-existent. I tried anything I wanted. Some were failures, but others really caught the voice I had in my head. I was happy with them, although I'm not sure I ever really learned to write them. Not well. Fabergé eggs they ain't. There's a mysterious short story thing the great writers do. I never figured it out. Mine are very, 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 very short novels. None the worse for it. They have beginnings and middles and ends. Something surprising happens or is revealed. And that's what they are. They're like five-page novels.
That sounds like the perfect little, you know, over a cup of coffee or just before you go to sleep, suddenly you can just get a little...
You've got 10 minutes available, you can read a book. Yeah. So, this will be out for Father's Day, and I think it'll be a big book for Father's Day, because...
Also, it's... you got to think, what does he do with all the starts for his books back in the day? And if they didn't go anywhere, they just get filed, and suddenly they're just a little short story. So,
yeah, and everyone's a different character. Most of them appear to be murderers of some kind or another.
The charming, but anyway, hey, look, Lee Charles, always good. I saw his
Safe Enough. It's called. I don't know what that means.
I saw series two of Jack when I was away.
I
think series three. So, trying to think of the title. They're shooting them in order or something like that. And it was his crew. Of investigators back when he was in the army have stumbled on something and they're starting to be eliminated and for what they know. And so Jack and the surviving members get involved. And it's sort of like missiles.
So is that one of the Jack Reacher novels? The
second one.
Oh, okay.
So Big Trouble and whatever. You know, I'm not sure what this title is. But anyway, hey, worthwhile watching. Yeah. Jack's in good form, throwing people out of helicopters and all that sort of stuff, you know, which is what he promised to do right at the start of the thing. The bad guy was going to go down. And the next one is about, I think he fights the giant, Paulie. If you ever go way back in your Jack Reacher sort of things. And the problem is, Paulie's about 7'3" and Jack's about 6'5". And at one stage in the book, I remember he holds this giant above his head. Now, he's going to start looking like some superhero. So I'm curious to see how they film something like that because, you know, it's a fine line. Jack's pretty indestructible. Anyway, we'll watch in the future.
Yeah, I don't know how you see these things because everything's on a different streaming platform and I can't.
In America, everything seems to be everywhere.
Yeah.
You just... people, houses, everybody. It's like here. They seem to have everything. That's if you want to click enough buttons, that suddenly you've got it. Wonderful.
And you get a bill for everything every month.
Yeah, you pay your life in little bits. I want to move on now to the humour section at Elmo's, which I have looked at. Tell me a little bit about that before I sort of throw a book into the mix on that topic.
Well.
There must be a lot of titles that come out. How do you pick? Is it your kind of sense of humour? Am I getting Steve down there? Or is it like you think this could... Did they sell well?
Well, there's lots of books that are funny, but they're mostly... I wouldn't put them in our humour section because they're biographies or they're about, funny book about gardening or something. The stuff we put in the humour section is stuff that actually sets out to be kind of like a joke book, really. Or, Garfield number 29 or...
Yeah.
Used to have it full of Foot Rot Flats, actually, but we've sold all those. I might get some more.
I was curious about just how popular it was because I read probably the last PJ O'Rourke book. Now, and it's called The Funny Stuff. And he lived from 1947, a very good year, 1947, and died in 2022. And he was an author, journalist, political satirist. 21 books. I'm sure you've read some of them back in the day. Some reaching number one on the New York Times best-selling list. He worked for sort of National Lampoon, and then he was kind of like Rolling Stone, and then he was basically a freelancer and... But he was like, when they put out the sort of book of quotations, he was the most quoted living writer. He was it.
That's because Churchill was already dead.
Right. And he has gone, and I've got a note here, he has gone into the Parthenon of, quote, gods, which puts him up with kind of like Oscar Wilde and Mark Twain and Dorothy Parker and Winston and people like that.
Yeah.
The Penguin Dictionary of Modern Humorous Quotes, published in 1987, he had more entries. And he was now, in 1987, he was going to write for another 35 years. So he has a lot of stuff in. Book in six parts, alphabetical order, from everything from agriculture to xenophobia. on government. Giving money and power to politicians is like giving whiskey and car keys to teenage boys, you know, that sort of stuff. Fishing, a sport invented by insects, and you are the bait. 50-year career, singular, acerbic voice. I thought he was, I liked him better than, like, well, I liked Tom Wolfe, I liked Hunter S. Thompson, you know, guys who were, could be very funny, but he was always something. Very, very Republican, conservative, you know, he dogged those Democrats, but he also dogged those Republicans too. You know, he was pretty anti-Trump, and yet he was a staunch Republican.
Well, that used to be possible to be that.
I know. He wore his talent, I think, lightly, and just saw himself as just another player in the human comedy. There wasn't a lot of ego when you read his books. They're just funny. If you've never read one of them, I do suggest, you know, if you ever see them in, you know, those Lions book sales or Rotary book sales or something like that.
We've still got some.
And we've still got some in the, at Elmo's.
Yes.
Oh, well, look, head off to Elmo's.
But I haven't got the one you're talking about. I'm not aware of that.
Well, I liked it. I thought it was particularly good, but it also just reminded me of all his great funny books, which some will probably date better than others, but very, very good. Okay, now, moving on, I notice over there a book, you've got some books about New Zealand. And
well, I just thought, leading on from the Y Word and the Crew Murders book, I just thought I'd bring along some recent New Zealand non-fiction, which people may know about. Life of Di, Di Henwood's book, which is, people who know him will know that in recent years he's been particularly unwell, but he's managed to keep on keeping on through all of that. And
it's, what's the comedy show on Thursday nights?
7 days.
7 days. I mean, he's not there every week, but when he does come on, he's good. He's our Di.
Yeah.
Loved his dad, Ray Henwood, the actor at Downstage. You know, he was that good an actor that didn't matter what he was in, if he was, you know, him or Tilly were in it, they drew an audience.
Yeah.
And
of course, his mum was a high court judge, I think, or district court judge, anyway.
So, I find him particularly, you know, apart from his championing the Warriors, which seems like such a bad thing to do for 20, whatever it is, years, but he's their guy.
Well, I know a lot of people like that. They're all pretty quiet this week.
And so they should be. I mean, man, that was score was... Yeah, I haven't. Well, I'm waiting to hear what people mock Di on Thursday night, but we'll get to that. Anyway, the book, I notice there's photos.
Yeah, so it's yeah.
Now, so this is written by him.
This is written by him. It's his story, and as I say, since he's had this, you know, stage 4 bowel cancer since 2020. So, but he's kind of
rocking on, and
so a lot of it's about dealing with that, and
because he's not just he's been a front man, a sort of compere, a kind of, you know, maitre d' of comedy. He's wide ranging guy, you know.
Well, I think,
and to make a living out of that,
to make a living in New Zealand doing anything except, you know, 9 to 5 working for a living, you have to be all things to all people, and whatever anybody says, would you like to, you have to say yes. Whether you can or you can't. Yeah. But so whether you think you can or whether you think you can't, you'll be right.
Yeah. I feel that book will have broad appeal.
Yeah.
You know,
he's a popular guy.
Oh, yeah. And some comedians can be very annoying, you know, trying to think, mainly, you know, American ones or, you know.
No, some of those are pretty irritating.
Jim Carrey? Was it?
Well, he just keep pulling those silly faces, doesn't he?
Yeah, that would drive someone I know very well. That drive them crazy. you know, there are just some who rub you the wrong way. Di, I think everybody loves them, so it's going well. Hey, I want to take, let's go into a sort of thriller place. Now, our book club is about to read later in the year, Out by Natsuya Korino. Now, this has been hard to get our book club to read, mainly because there are no copies of the book around.
I've never seen it.
So that's hard for a book club when you go, well, let's buy it. So no bookseller has it. There are no copies in the library. So suddenly it's a Kindle book for the book club, which, you know, and if your Kindle's like my Kindle, like 100 years old and now is not supported by those bad boys at Amazon, then I'm doomed. So I either buy a new super Kindle, which I'm a bit resistant to do. But anyway, I managed to get this for a couple of bucks from Thrift Bookshop or something, or rather some big online, which now are sending me endless emails because I'm their favourite guy. So
yeah, I get books from them for people occasionally.
Yeah, and it was fantastic. I mean, like $2 for an unknown book. I mean,
well, here it would be $2 for the book and $29.80 for the postage. But
yeah, no. But my plan was to spend, you know, many thousands of dollars on airfares so I could get this book. Anyway, Out, 1998. It was the winner of Japan's Grand Prix for crime writers, and also was an Edgar Award finalist. This book was it. Now, the author, born 1951, a mystery writer whose work goes well beyond the conventional crime novels. All her books have been made into movies, it seems. Very, very big. Literary mysteries, dark plot, dark realism. Now, this is dark stuff. But it's kind of laying down here, a nervy thriller. Out has the force of a juicy tabloid scandal, potent cocktail of urban blight, perverse feminism, and vigilante justice. What's right. Not to like? Especially the perverse feminism. That really, I mean, our book group, the women are very excited to know, you know, how this is going to roll.
A lot of blokes get carved up in that, are they?
Well, what happens? It's a story of a brutal murder in the Tokyo suburbs. This woman kills her abusive husband.
Yes.
Strangles him. And seeks help.
You think she'd found her?
And seeks help from her co-workers to dispose the body and hide the crime. Now they all work the midnight to 6 o'clock shift at, you know, making little boxes of food, sushi food, on conveyor chains. All right, so they're a little part of the group that works together, and they're great buddies.
They've got very sharp knives.
The four of them, yeah. Masako, cool, intelligent, emerges as the ringleader. The crime leads her on a terrifying foray into the violent underbelly of Japanese society. Very funny, dark book. I mean, as you're faced with the problem, like they have to get rid of the body, so they've got a sort of empty house. You have one of the people where the kids are at school, and they have to dismember it into 47 little packages and then hide it around the city in the rubbish. That's their technique for getting rid of it in little bits. And so that, of course, goes wrong, and suddenly the police are involved. A crime lord is kind of accused of the crime, and he loses a lot of his business, and he's out for revenge. He's now tracking down and investigating who actually did this. Their little group is breaking up as things happen. Terrific. And, of course, suddenly people contact them thinking, look, these guys are good at this, so can they do more business? So suddenly they're doing it again for a sort of like a disposal, and they've got a better system worked out. Very funny, very good. I loved it, and I think our book group will like it.
But how are they going to get? They're all going to borrow your one.
My one will go into circulation. It will be valuable. I could charge for this, actually.
I'd charge $2 a time.
Yeah, no, I will, of course, put it into the system, and they will Kindle it, as people have to do. We've resisted having a Japanese book for so long. That Neil,
you'd be upset about that because you like them, don't you?
I love them, and I have often put them up, but there is a voting body, and they, i.e. all of us, somehow have managed to keep these Japanese ones out. But this one is in the swing of things.
You could read When the Coffee Gets Cold. That only take about 10 minutes. It's quite short.
Yes, it's not for the faint of heart, by the way. And I thought it's one of those books you keep putting down to take a breath. You go like, oh, what is going here? But anyway, I enjoyed that. Putting that aside, let's have a look at our time. We're halfway through the show. Moving on to your next New Zealand book, since that's our theme today.
Okay, well, this is A Life Less Punishing by Matt Heath. So Matt, he's done really well with this, and it's kind of a 13 ways to love the life you've got. So it's one of those things about...
So this is a self-help book?
It's a self-help book.
But we don't have a lot from New Zealand in that area.
We don't. And he's done...
And it's massive. It's a massive amount of books.
Yeah.
And you go to... I went to a Barnes & Noble bookshop, you know, a real emporium. They had everything.
Yeah, Chicken Soup for the Soul and Don't Sweat the Small Stuff. And those books go on and on and on and on.
I know, and it's kind of like the same...
How to Win Friends and Influence People. Still... Happening.
I know, seven Covey's, seven things, and you know, like, hey, and I must admit, I have picked these books up.
Hmm.
You always also looking for sort of like the Holy Grail paragraph, which will make you understand yourself and your life.
Well, it's interesting, eh? $37.99. If you get one little thing out of it that makes you change something.
Oh. At that price, it's fantastic value.
Yeah. And if you only get that out of every second book.
How about, why is the fact that it's a New Zealand book and we all want to support our writers, what else is it kind of like, would you suggest that?
Well, it's done quite well because a lot of people know him. He's on the radio. I think he's on Hierarchy, I think. He's on that alternative commentary team that, you know, they do... Mostly do cricket.
I like
but they
cricket
also doing the Warriors, I think. And they have, it's always on a separate Sky channel with an R18 because
they're language.
A little colourful.
I'm liking it already.
Yeah. So, and it's done really, really well. So, as all I've done is just pick up a few current New Zealand non-fiction books that.
And Kieran Reid gives it on the front. Matt has a hilarious way of articulating an important message. Highly readable advice for everyone. Kieran Reid.
But he's also
all black.
But he's also. But Kieran's also on the telly extolling the virtues of property investments. So I don't know.
Yeah, no, they could kill it. I mean, as far as the articulateness of our All Blacks, I never really. Trying to think of the great ones who were really... Richie was classic. He was good. Trying to think of the guys who were really, really clever, who if they put their name on the book, that was really going to move it.
Anton Oliver was the best one. Oh. He said clever things.
Yeah.
He said...
He's an environmental... He was a green guy.
Well, but he said this thing once, about talking about, making tackles. He said, defence is a coefficient of desire. Now I'm thinking... You mean you really have to want to tackle people?
that's a really good way of, you're either in or you're not. Yeah. I want to take, going back, because I had my readings been a little bit looking back a bit, I found a book called Think Like a Freak, and that was published, now going back a bit, 2014, 10 years ago. Now, this is, what happens when you find yourself living in a small town in America with a little library, and they have these old books. But it was by Stephen Levitt and Stephen Dubnow, who were the writers of Freakonomics, which I loved. Mm. And this was a book about how to think like they did, because they became kind of like really interesting world figures because of their Freakonomics book. And it had the two chapters I really did love. The first one was about, why Asians were good at mathematics, and they postulated it was because they'd spent thousands of years thinking about how to plant rice. Now, it's a great reach to say, well, why? And the theory, the short version of it, is the fact that why Asians are good at mathematics is not an innate ability to be mathematical. It's that when they studied and researched people doing mathematical problems, they found that Asian students stay on the problem longer. Because, and they postulated, they had to survive back in the day for thousands of years about how to actually make it, configure it all and do it and make a living and survive. Without much land, and it was critical. So they didn't give up. If when I'm doing maths, I don't know about you, Steve, when I suddenly go and then it's done. Mathematicians, of course, good guys, they stick with it and play with it and eventually get it. And Asian students are very, very good. So it's not just a factor of their intelligence, it's a quality of perseverance and hanging in there. And the longer you hang in there, the better you get at solving maths, which I thought was a great little chapter about that. But I loved their one about why the crime in 1990 suddenly dropped in America, absolutely plummeted all the crime stats, and all the politicians and mayors took all the credit, saying, look, it's all our policies, you know, we're more police, we've got, you know, higher, tougher sentencing, we've got, you know, and they worked it all out. And these guys said, no. They went back and they said, like 20 years before that, Roe versus Wade, and they said, they looked at it, and very few abortions were reported. A year after Roe versus Wade came in, 1.6 million abortions. They said, that is a really interesting number, and that's what gets economists' attention. And they looked at it, and then they looked at it and just got bigger and bigger and bigger. 20 years later, the crime dropped, the stats there. Their argument was, those criminals were never born. So now, with the rolling back of Roe versus Wade, if we can live long enough, 20 years from now,
there'll be a crime wave.
We should see a huge crime wave, if their thesis is right. But this is the long-term way of looking at data and, you know, sort of figures. Anyway, think like a freak. How do you approach issues? And they're very unconventional. They said it's all about storytelling. They say put away your moral compass and just be open to the data is going to present to you. They say learn to say, I don't know.
And there's a lot of that all the time. Because it's
I think it's a great thing. I think, you know, if our elected officials actually said it more, we kind of give them more cred. But of course, what happens? I did research on kids, and they'd give them problems, and the kids wouldn't. There would be no way the kids would know, but the kids would provide answers. They'd just make it up.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing.
And they said these guys are going to be future, you know, city councillors. You know, they're going to be elected officials and lawyers. Thinking like a child. Take a master class in incentives. They say the world is ruled by incentives.
Mm-hmm.
They put the idea up, paying for academic results in schools.
So, like,
you get a, you know,
you get an A, you get $10, you get a B, you get $8.
And you really start to incentivize it. And they did some research on it, and that wasn't conclusive. But they said maybe it's because our incentives weren't high enough. They're pretty confident that if you said, look, if you, you know, start putting some serious money on it, students will rise to it. They like it. They want money, and they will suddenly be. And they went into all sorts of aspects of economic life, how it incentivized people and issues and countries.
We sort of incentivized academic achievement, don't we, by saying if you can do this, this and this, then
you get a scholarship.
You get a good job, and you know.
And
if you don't, you have to.
You're right. But I mean, if you pushed it down a bit for a bit lower levels and tried to get lift. I mean, we would be quite good to get our country slightly more educationally, you know.
Well, it'd be quite good if they went to school just occasionally.
Anyway, this book was fun to read. And also it said, like, the learn the upside and to appreciate the upside value of quitting. You know, you can't solve tomorrow's problems if you are not willing to abandon today's dud ideas. And so sometimes, you know, they thought, this is serious. Too many things is like they hang in. The idea doesn't work. Get rid of it. Get on with the next one. Hmm. Anyway, I like that book.
How to but think that's like, the opposite way that the Asians are good at maths, isn't it?
Yeah, they like we out the yeah because we're saying like yeah let's get the next problem up see if I can get that one. No, that's good.
That's what they say about proverbs, isn't there? For every proverb, there's you know stitch in time saves nine, but don't cross your bridge before you come to it.
You're good at that stuff, Steve. Now, and another book from you. You've got
well another part of my thesis on newish books about New Zealand nonfiction. So this is Final Diagnosis by Cynric Temple Camp. This is his second book. Cynric is a pathologist who hangs out in Palmerston North from a rare and deadly amniotic. I've never heard that word used in this context before. Avalanche to a victim of roasted peanuts. The best-selling author of The Cause of Death and The Quick and the Dead returns with more stranger-than-fiction stories of death, disease and murder, as well as new perspectives on high-profile cases, including the disappearance on Ben Smart and Olivia Hope, which is current, trial of Mark Lundy, which is kind of close to home. I knew some people who knew him. And the ill-fated journey of ANSET Flight 703. So, yeah, he's...
Is that we are, you know, if it bleeds, you know, it leads type of, you know, news absolutely. Thing. So in a book like that that goes like, you know, these are things we talk about. Mm. You know, is it the water cooler? Is that such an idea? Do you stand around the water cooler at Elmo's?
They haven't got a water cooler at Elmo's.
That's why I figured I've never seen one there. But you've got a cafe. You've got your own cafe. Yeah. So you've got your own water supply there. You know, it's talking about...
Mostly hot water with... coffee in it.
You've had the previous books?
Yeah.
And they've moved a little bit? And a local writer?
Yep.
So he's another one from Palmerston?
I think he's from Palmerston, yeah.
What is about that place? That's two from Palmerston. And what was the third one? Where did she come from, Catherine?
Oh, she's from Lyvyn.
Man, it's all happening on the other side of the hill, isn't it, really? I mean, outstanding.
Yeah, but it happens here too.
It does. Now, the Mary Beard.
Yes, she's a British televisional historian lady.
Professor of classics at Cambridge and a TV personality.
Yes.
And I've often picked her books up and put them down. But this time I picked up a book called A Little Slim Book. Called How Do We Look? And it was a look at how you look at antiquities. And I always thought, because when I go into museums and all that, and I look at antiquities, some blurry thing comes, and I start thinking the museum shop coffee, or, you know, and I tend to walk through it. I don't really get it so much.
Yeah, why the hell do they, all those coins, what I mean?
Yeah, and they've all got a story, and it's just an imaginative lack from me. Anyway, she's written a lot of books. Woman in Power, a Manifesto, her first big book was a sort of feminist thing. History of Ancient Rome, Pompeii, the Parthenon. But there's a latest book, which I haven't got the title, about the emperors of Rome. I've had a couple of people say, this is a good book. So now I'm on the lookout for that. The book's divided into the body, the divine, and the question of civilization. Great. This book had terrific photography in it. I love books full of pictures. If they're slim, it's like I'm made. And
if it's a slim book with a lot of pictures, that sounds...
it looks beyond the familiar canon of Western imagery... and asks what is civilization, which is always debated, and she gets right into it. How we depicted ourselves in the past, and it's kind of really fun to look at all the various old societies, how they did it, and it's kind of it's a bit of a meditation on the human body, and but it looks at Greeks and Romans and Chinese and the pharaohs, you know, with those little statues and all that sort of stuff, and puts who were right into size. They had the big things and all that. And terracotta warriors, all that sort of stuff, how they were portrayed, and then how the Greeks wanted to have, as you came into their house, they'd have statues of images of, terrific images of past members of the family and all that sort of stuff. The second section was the fun one, which is like, how do you get images and art into church, and which is, you know, like the divine, the idea of the invisible, and the idea of thou shalt not have idols, and yet you have suddenly you have all this art and sculptures and things of which people are, you know, idolizing. And that's always a conundrum, you know, for churches.
That's a bit of a scrap between the Protestants and the Catholics, isn't it?
It is. There was a little bit of work on that. But it got into Islamic mosques and just the knotty problems of making the divine visible. So I enjoyed that, and it made me think, and what I actually enjoyed was her writing.
Hmm.
What an absolute beautiful writer. You know, and didn't she could be writing about ferns, I think, and I would be, you know, interested in it. She just could write. It made reference to, I think, 1969, Kenneth Clark's Civilizations. Do you remember that?
That was a TV series.
The TV series, yeah. Which kind of looked at how this is where our civilizations were, which was really Western, she said, really quite a narrow take on it. But it was kind of, she said, it inspired her as a little child to get into this field.
Thought it was pretty dull.
Yeah, well, she absolutely slams it. But anyway, Beard is the world's most famous classicist, super writer, witty, erudite, conveys the thrill of discovering and reshaping ideas for modern audiences. So she's my go-to person. Now, if I'm going to read about the past, I've decided Mary Beard is the one.
Bethany Hughes, I think she's competitor.
TV personality?
Yeah. Kind of busty sort of a wench, but another professor of something somewhere or other.
Excellent. I felt better for reading it. It sounds like I would have felt better for reading Bethany, but...
well, maybe the pictures would have been... Anyway.
How to see better. What a great idea. Mm. We all want to see better, and... I did like that book a lot. Now, on our theme of New Zealand books, barbecue economics.
Yeah, because that was the other one I had picked out of our sort of current New Zealand non-fiction. It turns out that you got it out of the library.
I did. John Key, Sir John Key, a must read. Liam makes the complicated uncomplicated. A fun and easy read that gives us the how, why, and who of money and how it works in New Zealand, Mary Holm. Now, Mary Holm, Y Word?
She's been to Y Word, yep.
Yeah, and she's great. So there's two people, significant New Zealanders, giving this book a big tick.
Hmm. Well, Liam's been the economics and business correspondent for Radio New Zealand for a long time.
That appeals that someone who's not an economist tries to explain economics.
Yeah,
a journalist take on it because, well, somebody said, like, if all the economists
in the world were laid end to end, they still wouldn't reach a conclusion. Yeah.
No, I think they said I think the other version was that if they were all laid, you know, end to end, that wouldn't be a bad idea. I haven't read this, but I'm going to report back to us in July because it's. I kind of like these books if I can access them, if they are readable. And looking through this, I absolutely see no graphs. I am so happy. You know,
I'm not good at graphs.
I don't mind them, but they stop. You have to sit and puzzle and read the
which
axes.
Which is the x-axis and the y-axis, and have they got them the wrong way around? And what's the scale?
I know.
And does it start at zero, or are they bloody manipulating
things? Oh, a graph.
Things?
I just saw one. Supply and demand.
Yeah, well.
But we all started there. Remember Samuelson? I don't know if that was a text, you know, and it had like 4 million graphs.
All those little... Yeah, supply, and demand.
And you blurred after like half a page.
The intersection is the price point or some bloody thing. Yeah. I can't remember either.
Anyway, Liam is going to... this book, tell me, is it... I notice it's the first book I see when I come into Elmo's.
Yeah, well, we've got those, a little collection of those New Zealand non-fiction-y things down the front.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I saw a terrific review, and I'm pretty sure it was a good review in The Listener.
Mm.
So... or even North South, I think, have picked it up and reviewed it. Certainly a book for we get a lot of economics via our politicians. And
you can't trust what they say, though.
Yeah, but trying to understand...
Because they put a spin on things, obviously.
Yeah.
They have to. It's their job.
Yeah, but this, I think, hopefully would make us comprehend... a little bit of what they're saying, I hope, because they'll be using the language of barbecue. I mean, the idea of around the barbecue, we all sit and we talk about, you know, how it's all going, you know, to hell in a handbasket.
You know, when are the interest rates going to come down? When's that bloody Gavin all going to get his act together? And
was it
all Grant Robertson's fault? And
yeah, I mean, not all barbecue. The barbecues you and I have, we don't talk about. We talk about books and stuff, but... I do have people who like talking about this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And
you've read that, you'll be able to talk back.
I'll be able to whip in with them. Because I do have that view that I've just was reading a little bit about, you know, the prince and Machiavelli and all that, and how his idea that, you know, good people couldn't actually be rulers, that you needed to have a bit of a ruthless streak. And the idea is that, for the modern idea, is that sometimes we should allow a little bit of, you know, crap from our politicians, because it's a difficult job and they, you know, they have to do stuff often that's kind of like it's compromising, but they have to get things through and balance and all that. So that we should always cut them a little bit of slack. We want them to be terrific, but there is a bit of slack. Sometimes you're going to get it wrong. It's okay, guys. You know, that's just sometimes how it rolls. Anyway, barbecue economics.
The problem is that we, because we don't really, the way the press is, we don't really let them make mistakes. And if they do make a mistake, therefore, they can't admit it and they can't say sorry, because, you know, that's a sign of weakness and people then go for the jugular. So
perception, yeah, no, but I think, it's...
It's disappointing.
Anyway, we'll know more in July when we both, you know, I want you to read at least a chapter, and I'll get to do a bit more than that.
Mm.
I'm probably our second to last book, The Paul Murray's The Bee Sting.
Yep.
Now, this is 642 pages. I have read 13, just before I came out today. Excellent. Off to a great start, I think. Yeah.
You can tell, can't you? I reckon. Yeah. I did this thing once upon a time for this program. I did this thing on, you know, great first lines in literature. You probably remember it. And the point I was trying to make was that the first line of any novel or any book is the most important in the book, because everybody, when they pick up a book, they read that.
Yeah.
And if it says something.
Well, okay.
And that's the one that you should really, 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 really work and rework and...
Yeah. Here we go. In the next town over, a man had killed his family. He'd nailed the doors shut so they couldn't get out. The neighbours heard them running through the house screaming for mercy. When he had finished, he turned the gun on himself. Everybody was talking about it. And it goes on.
Yeah, see, that'll get you, won't it?
I know. And it goes, Elaine... had said she was surprised it didn't happen more often. She thrust her thumbs through her boot loops of her jeans and looked down at the dreary mean street of the town. I mean, she said, it was something to do. I mean, I go like, if it can make you laugh in the first paragraph.
Yeah.
You go like...
After some mass murder.
Yeah, after some mass murder, I'm going like, yeah, you Irish wizard. I'm buying into it. Everybody said this should have won.
Yes, the book that is.
The library stats bear that out in the sense that, you know, you can kind of try and book it today and you'll be 100th plus on the list, but you can buy it from Elmo's. Mm. There are copies there. But if you want to buy the winner, or if you want to get the winner from the library, Prophet Song, that's available today.
Mm.
So,
because it's a bit grim. It's not funny.
Well, we did review it here. Yeah. A couple of months ago, and that was Grim City, but we all needed a bit of grim. You know, it was autumn.
Yeah.
It was kind of right for it, but...
winter you need a bit of slightly less grim.
Anyway, our book club is getting into this, but I noticed in our book club someone has put the Wren.
The Wren, yeah.
And I'm going, like, that'll be like 5 Irish books in about 6 months, and I'm going,
98% of the writers in the world are Irish. And most statistics are made up.
It must be all the publishing houses operate out of Dublin or something like that. But it is an Irish city. And the trouble is there's a little group in our book club who love Irish. I'll keep you informed on how that rolls and how we're getting to it.
That's not a very big book, though, The Wren. So that won't take you long. That'll take longer.
I'm up for it. Okay, now we're winding down. We've got a couple of minutes. I was on the road. I picked up a copy of Ian McEwan's Sweet Tooth, a little thriller.
Yeah.
So
here's another guy. Every book's different.
I know. This book was twisty, and it's 2012, and it's I'd totally recommend it. Lovely story. Twist at the end that throws the whole book, just upturns your whole perspective of how it went. Cool little spy tale, and if you're a fan of Ian McEwan and you happen to miss it that one, like I did, you know, by all means pick it up just for the, you know, it's kind of Jane Austen meeting John le Carre. It's kind of like the way, and it's all about the storytelling, and, you know, I regard Ian McEwan as a modern master. Okay, to conclude the show, a young adult's book, which was... I was in Montana, and this was in their reading list for the local high school, and it was called The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian by Sherman Alexie.
Is that like a red Indian in Montana?
Yeah. So and it's a story of Junior, who is a budding cartoonist, who lives on the res, as they call it, the res, and he's got a variety of probs. He's picked on, he's determined to get a good... education, so he leaves the res and goes to school 22 miles away to an all-white school in the local town, which has no Indians, but Junior is arriving. He attacks life with humor and it's a coming of age. Inspired by the writer was, I think, had a similar upbringing, so he was able to draw on that. Excellent in every way. This was a very zingy, funny, I don't know if our, you know, it was the sort of book, I don't know how it gets through American censorships, but, you know, New Zealand kids would love it because of our freer way of looking at things, but gets right into racism and bullying and alcohol and high school basketball, teenage romance, it's just very, very original. Remind me when I was reading it of like Angela's Ashes. You know how that was sort of tragedy comedy, but it was like, you know, it was that bleakness of childhood.
Mm.
This is that too with the res guy.
Was that Frank McCourt or something?
Yeah, Frank McCourt. Even like little shades of, you know, Catcher in the Rye. Yeah, it's funny how books resonate, you know, and you go, hey, I came with that. Rat-a-tat-tat. Joke, you know, they're just sort of very, very funny, and the dominant mood was comic, but it was very sad, and I guess that's the Angela Ashes, why that kind of came to mind. You know, how you kind of like laugh as it breaks your heart, you know, and it's a book that you could just tear up a little bit, you know. Wonderful novel for teens. I doubt if it'll ever find its way over to here.
It's not likely.
No. It's not.
Unless it wins a prize or something, but...
Anyway, that brings us to the end of another terrific hour of books. Enjoyed talking about all those things. Thank you again from Steve and myself.
Thank you, Gareth.
You can catch this program on Elmo's Bookshop Facebook page, and we look forward to catching up with you soon.